According to new research, while we sleep, our brains clear out harmful toxins, a process that may reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is neurologist Dr. Eric Daikin, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He'll tell us about this new study, which suggests that sleeping is kind of like a dishwasher for your brain. Also, some sleep problems related to smartphones, tablets, and computer screens. Dr. Daikin will also answer your sleep-related questions. On our sleep news, after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and several times a year we like to invite Dr. Eric Daikin into our studio, neurologist, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, to talk about the latest sleep news and answer your questions. This is one of those days. Dr. Daikin in our Iowa City studio, welcome to you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
We want to reach out to our listeners because we know you do have sleep problems. It's what 60 million, something like that, Dr. Daikin, who have chronic sleep problems around the United States, a huge number.
Actually, you know, 70% of all normal Americans, 3 to 5 times per week, if you stretch the definition of sleep problems. So, yeah, I guess we can all relate.
Okay. So what keeps you up awake at night? Have you had an unusual sleep problem or experience? You'd like to tell us about it? You have a sleep-related question. 1-866-780-9100. River to River at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. As a matter of fact, on our Facebook page, Dr. Daikin, we'll talk about this a little bit later, an unusual sleepwalking instance from Boston where actually a woman in a subway gets up off a bench, sleepwalks, and falls into the tracks. She is hurt, but nothing past, I think, hurting her arm. We'll talk about that a little bit later. We'll post that video on our Facebook page as well. You can also post a question there, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. I know you probably have some of your latest research I want to ask you about in just a minute, Dr. Daikin, but some interesting sleep research, some studies that I'd like to get your reaction to. We've heard of people being brainwashed, of course, in the bad sense, as in, indoctrinated. But there's a new study that indicating our brains, they do this naturally, and it may be a really good thing. Researchers say that while the brain sleeps, it clears out harmful toxins, a process that may reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. And here's what the study found. In mice, during sleep, the flow of cerebrospinal fluid in the brain increases dramatically, washing away harmful waste proteins that build up between brain cells during waking hours. It's like a dishwasher, says Dr. Mikan Niedergaard. He's a professor of neurology, neurosurgery at the University of Rochester and the author of the study published in Science. What do you think of this, Dr. Daikin?
Well, it's interesting, and we've noticed and we've known for years that there's been an increase in cerebrospinal fluid flow, and actually, instead of the brain wash, the brain flush might be better. You're
okay.
Taking away those toxins. And, you know, it's an interesting thought. We know from animal studies that if an animal is deprived, and that's where we base that for humans, they will die. There's something restorative. And this is just one of the multiple interesting avenues, very interesting thought. But, you know, that increased cerebrospinal fluid, which may also translate to increased pressures in the brain, in some cases can also have an adverse effect. So if we just wanted to debate and talked about this, it is fascinating. What an interesting thought. And doesn't it open the door for future research and advances? But whether it's cause and effect, whether it's really a preventative kind of a measure, who knows? Interesting finding, though, as of yet.
Mm-hmm. But isn't it interesting, too, because isn't the case with types of dementia, Alzheimer's and so forth, that they almost always have poor sleep?
And that's where the one study with the humans that you were discussing with me earlier, and I read some of the papers you asked me to read, they've seen in Alzheimer-like patients, there's a degeneration of nerves, portions of the brain that help you think, but the portions that help you sleep also degenerate. So is it that degenerative process that's causing poor sleep, or is the poor sleep that's causing the degenerative process is still a big question, but interesting findings and a great place to start in an attempt to correct something that could improve a patient's quality of life.
Okay, here's another related study. I think you were just referring to it, a study by researchers at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the authors asked 70 adults, average age was 76 according to this study, about their sleep patterns, the duration, the quality of their sleep, and the participants then underwent brain imaging to look for the amount of this beta amyloid plaque, the protein involved in Alzheimer's. And those who reported having trouble sleeping or not getting enough sleep, considered to be less than 5 hours, according to this study, had a greater buildup of this amyloid in the brain. And this really connects with the other one. So is the bottom line here, Dr. Dyck, in not getting enough sleep or not getting good sleep maybe linked to the buildup of this abnormal protein? Or is it, as you said, the chicken or the egg, right?
Yeah, still chicken or the egg. Very interesting finding. But between you and me, when we're debating the topic, and what we think is that very visible amyloid on the MRI, the X-ray of the brain, actually there's probably invisible infiltration in the various centers that help us keep awake and asleep. But we've noticed certain groups of patients that are prone to Alzheimer-like dementia, the Down syndrome population. That seems to be reversing to some extent. And I think in that case, it's because we've discovered a strong association between untreated apnea and Down syndrome. We aggressively address that apnea, treat these patients, and it's amazing how Down syndrome patients are living longer and longer. And here in Iowa City, many of our patients are paying taxes, working right next to you and me like they weren't years ago, and living longer. So could it be that certain disorders like sleep apnea, where you get low oxygen to every part of your brain, they're predisposing to these plaques? And if you treat apnea, then you treat Alzheimer, and you treat a sleep problem, and then you've got a positive domino effect. Pure speculation, though. Lots of fun to talk about.
If you just joined us, neurologist Dr. Eric Dyken with us, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We're catching up on the latest in sleep research, also fielding your questions. 1-866-780-9100. What keeps you awake at night? Share your sleep problem or question. Perhaps you had a period of bad sleep and then you found a solution that you'd like to share with us. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to our first caller. Nikki is tuned in from Dubuque. Hi, Nikki.
Hi, how are you guys?
We're doing well.
Great,
what's your question or your sleep problem?
Well, I guess I have a slight problem here. I've had some sleeping problems for the last few years, and for a while I was treating it by taking Zolpidem, going to sleep, and I realized that was really making me very groggy in the morning. So I was able to wean myself off of that and kind of get to a regular sleep habit. But recently I've started using a device called a Fitbit. And basically, it's like a kind of a super enhanced pedometer, basically, that kind of looks at, obviously the number of steps you're taking during the day, but also it kind of regulates or it monitors your sleeping at night. And I've been noticing that as I check my sleep on the Fitbit that I'm, even though I go to bed and I might be getting, be in bed between 6 and 9 hours, I'm only averaging about 4 to 4.5 hours of, I guess, quality sleep a night, and the rest would qualify as restless sleep. And so I guess I'm kind of wondering, what I can do to improve the quality of sleep I'm getting. I really don't want to go back on Zolpidem, but I wake up absolutely exhausted every morning. And so when I saw that result, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. So,
Dr. Dyken, what do you have to say to Nikki?
Well, it's interesting because we use a similar tool in research. It's called actigraphy, and essentially it's a movement monitor. We have normal movements in sleep, but as she's implied, her movement monitor, if I'm translating well, is going off a little bit more than what they find is their normal control. So maybe she's getting restless sleep. Now, we have an international classification of sleep medicine textbook that has 95 specific differential diagnostic categories that can cause for a quote-unquote restless night of sleep. 90%, in my opinion, of the things that bother a lot of us can be taken care of by the patient or their primary care physician. you've already used a lot of smart thinking. You're trying to use good sleep hygiene practices, going to bed at root time. You're monitoring your routine sleep. You're trying to get the 8 to 9 hours grandma told you to get, and you're still having a sleep problem. Again, be careful when a doctor on the radio tells you the answer to everything. You've taken things far enough that I would sit down with my general practitioner, the backbone of medicine, and talk about a full sleep history, about the other elements that might be unique to you that might relate to one of these 95 different categories for which there are specific therapeutic interventions, because I've already think you've given it the good college try.
Okay, Nikki, I hope that helped you, and we're wishing you good sleep.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
No problem.
Nikki dialed 1-866-780-9100. Our next caller is Adam. Adam from Pella. Hi.
Hi. I'm just wondering, what's the easiest way for me to figure out what my natural sleep patterns are?
Oh, I got an answer for that. And we do that all the time. What we usually like to do is on vacation, when you can do anything you want, you pick out what is the most ideal time for your life situation, your desires, and try to take that as your routine bedtime and keep it as a routine bedtime 7 days a week during that vacation period of time and see when you wake up and when you're satisfied with sleep. Monitor that out over a 2 to 3 week period, and that may be your natural sleep time. And in fact, where they really looked at this was the early mammoth cave studies, where they would get rid of the sunlight's effects, take people in the bowels of the dark caves, and they would just let them free run, and they would see how long and when they would go to sleep naturally. That's where they found out, simplistically, we're really more of 25-hour animals than 24-hour animals. It's easier for us to stay up later than to go to bed earlier in general. But that's a generalism that I'd recommend to you.
Adam, for what specific reason, if I may ask, would you want to know your sleep pattern?
I guess recently out of college, coming out of the standard staying up late, maybe missing that 8 o'clock class once in a while, and trying to adapt to a normal 8 to 5 work hour. So just trying to get settled into that.
Okay,
that type of thing.
It's an interesting question. Thank you, Adam, calling from Pella, 1-866-780-9100. Now, Dr. Daikin, so we have each of us very individual sleep patterns. How varied can that be from one person to another?
Well, you know, it's a bell-shaped curve, if you will. Most of us, like Grandma says, need 7 to 9 hours of sleep, usually going to bed, you know, somewhere from 9 to 11 at night when it gets dark because of the melatonins and the response of the body's physiological system to the sun and to the darkness, and we tend to wake up when the light comes up over the mountain and wake us up for a day. That's how we've adapted, but there are the feats of the bell-shaped curve. Some people only need 5 hours. Some people need 10 or more hours. So what is normal? And as Adam said, he's smart. Know thyself. If you try to adapt to 9 hours of sleep, but you're really a 6-hour sleeper, you could go crazy. Try to get more sleep when you're not sleepy.
Right, and then you constantly thinking something must be wrong with me.
Absolutely, and that's the sleep state misperception, which is a very real disorder. And as he also mentioned, you can negatively condition after being a student year after year, and you may not know what normal is. And my thought is, God bless vacation, and then common sense. Most people can figure out for common sense and these little practices like a sleep diary what is right for them without paying millions of dollars, going to every doctor, or worrying themselves to death.
Dr. Daikin was with us, the director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, talking about the latest sleep research in the news and also fielding your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Before we go back to calls, I always like to find out what you're doing in the area of research. I know you have something that may be ripe for announcing on this, but perhaps not. You're dealing with something that studies twitches during sleep, Dr. Daikin?
Well, actually, it's what they call translational medicine, and our movement disorder expert, the past chairman of neurology at the University of Iowa, Dr. Robert Rodnitsky, and I, many years ago, 22 years ago, I think to be exact, saw in patients with stroke and paralyzed limbs from a variety of injuries to the central nervous system, the brain, and the spinal cord, that when they went to sleep, that paralyzed part of the body seemed to twitch. And there's some indication from animal studies that that twitching may predict, prognosticate recovery, and that if you help that twitch with physical therapy, aggressive, more prolonged, and maybe even twitching with electrical stimulation during a specific stage of sleep, REM, rapid eye movement, dreaming sleep, you may help recovery. And how often do the two meet? People who do clinical research on humans and then animal research. So I met Dr. Bloomberg over here in the Department of Psychology, who does twitching experiments on animals and translating the recovery and the development of twitches that we've seen in animals. So some of the recoveries we've seen in people as famous as Christopher Reeves, the Superman fellow who had spinal cord injury, but with aggressive therapy was able to move and go off the ventilator for periods of times. Bringing those two groups together is something we've just done with some new research ideas. And wouldn't that be great in the distant future to take people who can't move and give them that opportunity with appropriate prognosticating capabilities and therapeutic interventions to move again? So fingers and toes crossed for the long term.
Mm-hmm. So do dogs and humans twitch for the same reason? I know observing my dog, it will get to go make it meep, 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 sounds like this and be twitching arms, legs, snout, be twitching. And we always imagine that they're off on the hunt, you know, having a fabulous dream.
Well, and there are sometimes we swear that's what's going on. Anna Freud did a lot of early work on that. We call that oneric behavior, where you're acting out a dream. We know that can be pathological in some patients with certain injuries to the brain, where they can actually act out and hurt themselves in a dream. But in that dreaming sleep, REM sleep, there are also twitches associated with other body movements. So categorizing one movement as opposed to a reparative movement is what we're in the process of doing, because you'll move to pick up your coffee. You'll move to get away from a train or a car. So we have different movements while awake, and we have different movements while asleep, and they're not all the same thing. And as you said, you're talking about dream enactment, oneric behavior, where you see the dog chasing that rabbit. You know he's chasing a rabbit. But we're looking at the very subtleties of the deeper stages of sleep, REM sleep, to see if the twitches that don't look like they're chasing anything are reparative and opening up the avenues for people to recover no movement to some movement.
Okay, we're hoping this is a promising work for the future. We'll stay tuned to your twitches research, Dr. Dyke.
And appreciate
it. Let's go back to our phones. Molly in Wapello dialed 1-866-780-9100. Hi, Molly.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure
my
thing.
Question is, about 5 years ago, I did a sleep study, and I was diagnosed, I believe it's with hypoxia, where I just don't breathe deeply enough, but I don't actually have apnea. Now, 5 months ago, I had gastric bypass surgery, and I have lost 100 pounds and still losing, wondering when I do a sleep study again to see if I still need the CPAP machine.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, because, I did for the bariatric group here, I did the patient support group in 100 pounds. I mean, it takes, as you've implied, the extra tissue that may be on the chest and the throat areas that might make you no longer have a need to use a breathing assistant device like a CPAP, which stands for continuous positive airway pressure therapy, that a lot of people with sleep apnea, obstructive sleep apnea that I have, or hypoventilation, where we just can't take as deep a breath at night because of the weight, simplistically speaking. So because you've lost so much weight, our general rule is about 10% of your body weight from the studies from the Wisconsin cohort with Terry Young and Dr. Papard. They've shown that if you've lost that much weight, 50 pounds to 100 pounds, you have less weight that's inhibiting your breathing, and maybe a repeat study to see if you even need CPAP or maybe at a lower pressure is appropriate. And for my laboratory, if you lose 50 pounds, I would repeat the study.
Mm. And your laboratory is where I go. So.
Oh, God bless. Well, give us a call. Yeah, let Chris know. Just give a call. And my thought is I would go ahead and do it in a heartbeat. I think we
All
can
right.
justify that.
Dr.
Thank
Dyke,
you very much.
Thank you, Molly in Wapello. Dr. Dykin, if you'd like to give out the number of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa, please do so.
Yeah, yes, 319-356-3813. So any other patients out there that need follow-up, just give us a call. Every once in a while we drop the handle. We don't mean to. But, yeah, just give us a call. That's the sleep lab. We've got 12 of the best techs in the world working over there, my opinion. And someone's always there 7 nights a week.
Okay, Dr. Dykin, we have several more people on the line. Let's try to get at least one more before we take a short break. 1-866-780-9100 is our number. Let's go to Millie. Millie is calling from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Millie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My question is, I've been taking Zolpidem now for the past 3, maybe 4 years now, and I'm wondering, is that a bad thing? And also, is a person able to come off of that medication after a while? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, you know,
thank you, Millie.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, we were part of some of the early industry-related projects on Zolpidem. And in the old days, we would try never to use Zolpidem or any of the other sleep aids for over a 3-week consecutive period, although there were studies that imply, as Millie has had, that you might be able to use them for more prolonged periods of time should you need those medications. And there are certain sleep disorders, and it depends on how you're doing, Millie. There's a sleep disorder just called intrinsic insomnia, where people are born from infancy without the normal neural chemicals that are in the ventral preoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus, all the big, tough Latin words. The research has shown that these chemicals are low. So in some people, the use of a medicine like Zolpidem, which is actually mimics that neurotransmitter GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, it's replacing what the body's missing. It's holistic, if you will. It's natural medicine. So if that's your diagnosis, well, I'd stay on the medicine. But again, that's why what you want to do is make sure you're following with a good general practitioner, a good family medicine doctor, backbone of medicine in the United States who knows these basic elements, and do what they recommend based on what the common sense would be. But if you're just taking it because you were under stress for a period of time, the stress is gone, well, why not slowly taper off that medication underneath the guidance of a healthcare professional who is familiar with the medicines? So talk to your doc. See what he says or she says.
Okay. Millie in Cedar Rapids, thank you for that question. We're coming up. I've got about a minute left before we have to take a short break. Hey, Dr. Dykin, perhaps you can tell us a little bit for those who are having problems or typically have problems when we switch times, which we're going to be doing in the coming weekend, daylight saving time. We're getting ready to fall back on November 3rd, the next Sunday at 2 a.m. So we like to say we get an extra hour of sleep. Does this switch, admittedly only an hour, cause any sleep disruption in some people?
Yeah, and especially the older we get. We have this biologic clock called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. And for most young people, every 1 hour shift in your waking time, bedtime, it takes you about a 24-hour period to really fully adjust. So when you look at all the people who have increased car wrecks and all these other things that are reported when there's a change in that this period of time, it's often maybe related to that change. So be careful the first 24 hours after the time changes.
Okay. The music tells us we have to take a break. Dr. Dykin is with us, neurologist, and he is the head of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. We invite your calls also in the second half hour. Sleep research, your sleep questions, 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a few minutes with more of Dr. Dykin and your sleep questions.
I'm so tired. My mind is set on you. I wonder, should I?
So glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and the U.S. Supreme Court's new term started this month. After last year's series of surprising and tumultuous rulings, eyes are once again trained on the nation's highest court. Tomorrow on this program, we'll sit down with two of our legal experts, Todd Pettis and Song Richardson of the University of Iowa Law School. They'll tell us about 4 new U.S. Supreme Court cases, including one case that involves the question of criminal liability for an Iowa heroin dealer whose client overdosed. That's tomorrow on this program. a look at some of the high-profile cases before the U.S. Supreme Court. This hour, we're catching up on the latest in sleep research, fielding your questions. Neurologist Dr. Eric Daikin with us. We like to call him our sleep doctor, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, fielding your questions, 1-866-780-9100. Also email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We're on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Before we go back to the callers, as a matter of fact, we've got a link to this interesting story, scary story, on our Facebook page, Dr. Daikin, from Boston in some security footage that you'll see on this link from October 21st, released by the Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority. This supposedly sleepwalking woman gets up, walks onto the subway tracks, falls right down in that track area, and then moments later, a group of passersby emerge. They rush to her aid, several people jumping down to hoist her back up to safety. Now, I think she only suffered some injury to her arm. Thankfully, they got her up this rather deep well, and she said that she was sleeping, I think, on a bench and just got up, fell asleep, and then started to sleepwalk. So, Dr. Daikin, I don't know if you've had a chance to look at this video, but people can really do pretty much anything while they're sleepwalking, can't they?
Well, actually, it's a semantics. And, you know, we had Mrs. Allgood, who's sort of a national iconic figure in regard to sleepwalking and family problems that can arise. People can walk in front of a truck, and that's what her son did. That's what we speculate that had happened in his case. But sleepwalking specifically is a behavior, a movement. We've talked about movements in sleep at a very specific stage of sleep. And after a sleepwalking event, you usually don't scream and yell for help. You're still confused because you don't wake up. Mm. And what you do for a sleepwalker, and it's a normal phenomenon in children, they generally outgrow it. So it's unusual for an adult to sleepwalk, quote unquote, sleepwalk. But what would you call it? Now, I think in this lady's case, she fell down. There's no question she was, quote unquote, sleepwalking to a certain degree, but not the same sleepwalking that a child does. So as we implied early in the show, 70% of all normal Americans are sleep deprived. And when you're significantly sleep deprived, you can walk on fumes. And that's N1 or early stage sleep of drowsiness, where you're just not quite thinking well and you can go right off the side of a subway station onto the tracks. And then immediately afterwards, you can scream and yell for help, which is a little different than what we call somnambulism or formal sleepwalking. But arose by any other name. Oh, yeah, I have a feeling this lady could have been so tired, so sleep deprived. You can do the wrong things. And if you walk out in front of a truck, you walk onto a subway track. So, yeah, you know, sleep deprivation is dangerous. And when a truck driver falls asleep behind the wheel of the rig, people can be hurt. And as such, because work has been done in that regard, we have the safest truck drivers in the world. God bless them. Mm-hmm. So my thought is, oh, yeah, it's very scary what you can do when you're sleep deprived. And it meant a lot to, but I appreciate, you hooked me into that when I took a look at that. And yeah, it's very frightening.
And our listeners can find that link on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. So it sounds like what you're saying, if you or a family member have suddenly a bout of sleepwalking, one of the first things to check is just to say, are you getting less sleep? Are you sleep deprived? That could be an indication, right?
Common sense, patient, heal thyself. Just as what was it, Adam? Or, you know, earlier on, he says, right, "Let me take inventory of how I'm sleeping." Then ask him, "Are you sleeping 7 to 9 hours a night?"
Okay, let's go back to our phones. 1-866-780-9100. Catherine from Marshalltown, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead, Catherine.
A daughter, and since childhood, she has suffered from night terrors, is what they called it. They told us she would outgrow it. She's now 27 years old, and she still doesn't get a good night's sleep because she wakes up from extreme nightmares. Is there anything she can do, and where should she seek help?
Okay, we didn't get the first part. It was a little choppy. Is this your daughter, Catherine, or a relation?
Yes.
Okay, so now 27 years old, still having night terrors. Dr. Daikin, what can we do for Catherine?
Well, actually, what Catherine said was night terrors as a child, We call that pavor nocturnus, a nice Latin term. Mom's proud I learned that term. And she said nightmare as an adult, which is the proper way. Usually the night terror is a normal phenomenon of children. We outgrow that. And it's similar to sleepwalking. It's similar to what we call confusional arousals. But nightmares are what we often develop as we become older, where we have a dream. We have a lot of stress and pressure in our life, and that dream comes out as a very specific description of whatever it was chasing you, whatever the problem may be. Nightmares are normal phenomena in people under stress or pressure, to the extent of post-traumatic stress disorder, et cetera, et cetera. When nightmares are severe, my first recommendation is you see an expert, and that's a psychiatrist or a psychologist who is well-trained in people with nightmares. Because Rosalind Cartwright, one of the world leading experts from Chicago Rush Presbyterian, can analyze those nightmares, for example. They can ask you about what's bothering you, do the full history and physical exam that a good healthcare professional should do before they jump into any therapeutic intervention. But if I have a relative, 27 years old, who has major problem with night terror, I would send him to one of our psychiatrists who's an expert, and that would be Dr. M here at the University of Iowa, or Dr. Bajpai. But again, there are experts like those all over. I wouldn't necessarily send him to a neurologist like me. But that's okay. What I'd recommend at this point.
Okay, thank you very much.
No problems.
Thank you, Catherine in Marshalltown, 1-866-780-9100. Before we go to our next caller, Dr. Daikin, a little bit more of the sleep research in the news. If those of us who are hoping to sleep in on the weekend and getting caught up on our sleep that we didn't get during the week, this is perhaps not good news. A study by Penn State University's Hershey Sleep Research and Treatment Center found that catch-up sleep really doesn't work. Here's what they did. 30 healthy adults instructed to sleep 8 hours for the first four nights, 6 hours for the next six nights, and 10 hours for the next three nights in an attempt to simulate sleep loss and sleep recovery. The study found that while the 2 days' worth of sleep recovery sleep lowered the level of interleukin, is it? Interleukin-6 in the participants' blood, inflammation agent in the body, overall attention performance did not improve. So what does this mean, Dr. Daikin? You can catch up to some degree, but not completely?
Yeah. You know, and it's, you know, can't fool Mother Nature. You and I doing a similar talk many years ago, one of my truck driver patients actually called and said, you know, Dr. Daikin, I'm trying to avoid those daytime naps. So I'm out here in my 40-ton rig. I'm about to fall asleep, but I'm not going to take that nap. I'm going to wait till the night to save up my sleep drive for it. I said, pull over, take a nap. So he might not have had as great attention in this study, but if he took a half-hour power nap, he's probably going to be a lot safer on the road. So relatively, like you said, they may not be at their optimal performance if they're not getting routine, good bedtimes and awakening times, seven nights a week, every week of the year. So, I mean, it's good to have general good habits. But what this study shows is don't think you're fooling Mother Nature and you're going to make it all up in one weekend. Nevertheless, the good news is that interleukin 6, that inflammatory factor, went down, and that's not a good thing to have elevated. We think that may injure your blood vessels and cause hypertension. So good news and bad news, but it's not going to be a complete cure for everything. Catching up with sleep is really hard to do completely in one weekend.
Neurologist Dr. Eric Daikin with us, director of the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa, 1-866-780-9100. Carol is joining us, hopefully safely joining us by phone from somewhere on I-80. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. No, I'm not driving.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
My husband is driving. No, I had a question for Dr. Daikin. Several years ago, my husband started kind of his body would twitch at night, and all of a sudden he would start kicking. And sharing a bed, I'd have to get out of the way. Then more recently, he would sometimes start punching with his fist. And I'd wake him up, and we think perhaps it's related to dreaming, but we really don't know. It happens occasionally, not on any special schedule.
Okay, Carol, Dr. Daikin.
Yeah, to me, until proven otherwise, this could be one of three things, and it's a real interest of ours. When an individual is actually able to punch out from sleep, it implies they've lost the paralysis that's normal to REM or dreaming or paralyzed sleep. So when you watch your dog and they're obviously sleeping and look like they're chasing a rabbit, well, that's sort of controlled. But when they can actually punch out, it implies what we call the REM sleep behavior disorder. Now, you can see that in a variety of disorders. But you can also see people with obstructive sleep apnea, which is usually worse. The airway gets floppy in REM sleep. It starts to close down, and you can act out your dreams when you're struggling to wake up with a low oxygen apneic event where you're stopped breathing. And then some people have had injuries to their brain, etc., can sometimes have seizures where they punch out in sleep. But in his age group, doesn't look like he's got a lot of other problems. I'd rule out apnea versus REM sleep behavior disorder, because apnea, if you treat that with CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure, the mask that I wear, you can sleep throughout dream sleep without it interrupting that. You don't wake up punching out of your dreams. If you don't have apnea and you have what we call REM without atonia, this may be the REM sleep behavior disorder, which we treat with a medicine called clonazepam, and we also counsel because you might be at higher risk within a 10 to 13 year period of developing a disorder like Parkinson's disease. So it could mean a million different things, not to frighten you, but come on in if this is a major problem. We'll see you in the clinic. We'll ask you more specific questions, look under the hood, and then hopefully do the appropriate thing. So be careful with everything I just said. I wouldn't worry too much, but it'd be good before you're on the other end of that punch to be seen by your doctor.
Okay. Thank you very much.
No problems.
Carol, thank you for joining us. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to Dana. Dana, you're calling from Iowa City, I believe. Welcome to our program.
Thank you. My question is about blood sugar level and sleep, because I've been insulin dependent for 51 years and trouble sleeping. And how does your blood sugar level affect your ability to sleep soundly?
Well, I guess my question would be, how does the blood sugar level affect your ability to live, period? And we know that low blood sugar, both. You have to have glucose in your system for the brain to survive just as much as oxygen. So that low sugar, as all diabetics know, can be just as dangerous or more so to survival as too high of a blood sugar. So we know it can affect how you feel during the day, right? We know it can affect you just as well as night. And as you probably know, there's a phenomenon called somnogy, where you may actually, for whatever reason in sleep, drop your blood sugar level to dangerously low levels, and that's a scary thing. So oftentimes, following with an expert, an endocrinologist, your general practitioner who may know your blood sugars, with routine blood sugar checks and looking at your insulin and your diet and your exercise, how much sleep you're getting, the whole package. So that I don't oversimplify this, this is where you need a healthcare professional who is an expert at all these issues, knowing that sleep could affect all of that. And in fact, I think that might allow Ben to segue into that. We've looked at that, diabetes and shift workers.
Yeah, let's do that. Dana, did you feel taken care of there?
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, Dana, I hope Dr. Daikin answered your question, because we got some research actually related to blood sugar.
She did. Thank you.
Thank you, Dana, from Iowa City. The research that you're referring to, Dr. Daikin, people who do shift work, according to a new study, may have a higher risk of diabetes. And even those who eventually return to daytime work schedules, they have some sort of risk. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh found that any amount of shift work, whether it's just a few years or an entire lifetime's worth, is linked with a higher risk of diabetes. So, Dr. Daikin, how do you interpret that?
Well, what it was interesting, you know, it's more of a poll taken of over 1,000 different patients, but they also tended to have higher body mass index, which means they were heavier. That means – and we don't mean to be a denigrating term, but the reason we use the term obesity is it does parallel a risk for hypertension, heart disease, stroke, and diabetic risk. So that study didn't just look at shift working and the risk for diabetes. It looked at body mass index, which to me, as I've said before, see your general practitioner. There's a lot of things that can be comorbidities. And if your body mass index is up, you may have a heavier throat, more tissue in the back of your throat. You may be at risk for obstructive apnea. And when you get low oxygen to every cell in your body, there's a higher risk of developing or having concomitant diabetes, insulin resistance, and a phenomenon we call leptin, insulin resistance and leptin resistance, where it's easier for you to have blood sugar problems and control or difficulty losing weight because when you eat, your metabolism doesn't kick up and you're not satiated. So in that regard, I'd have her make sure she talks to her doctor about all these other comorbidities and, in my bias, rule out sleep apnea.
Okay, we've got time for a couple more of our listener questions, callers. Let's take Susie from Des Moines. Hi, Susie.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
Doing fine. Great. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a son who is going on 14, is still wetting the bed. He also was born with sensory neural hearing loss. And I personally think there's some kind of a connection, but I have not been able to find anything about that. We've tried several things, and right now, the only thing that's working is avoiding soda pop and then some Demipressin that he's taking in the evening. But I just wanted to know if the doctor had any other suggestions.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting. We hate to pick people's pockets, but most pediatricians feel comfortable when a pediatric expert is addressing things rather than an old adult. Physician. Now, my expert is my wife. She's the expert on sleep disorders in the pediatric division here at the University of Iowa. And I'm sure that she would recommend you come in for counseling just to ease your mind, because the first thing she would say is, did you know that maybe 5% of all normal, and you have a normal son, normal kids up to age 16, especially boys, can still wet the bed, and I wouldn't worry about it. Easy to say when he wants to go for overnights, and he might be embarrassed at camp, but you have a normal son until proven otherwise. I think you should sit down with Debbie, at least give her a call at the Department of Pediatrics, Center for Disability Development. She's the sleep expert. Just a phone call might ease your mind, and until he's 17, you have a normal son. I wouldn't worry about him.
Okay, thank you. So, and same last name for your wife?
Lynn Dyken, Lynn-Dyken. And then she can ask about, there are other issues you want to make sure that I haven't glossed over, but until proven otherwise, my son was doing that. I give him a big hug and say, I understand you're worried about the overnight, but you're a normal kid.
Okay, Susie.
Yeah, we're trying to calm and ease him down because he's really hard on himself about it.
Give him a big hug.
Thank you so much.
Susie from Des Moines, thank you very much. You know what we're going to do, Dr. Dyken, we'll put the number for the Sleep Disorders Center at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics on our Facebook page right after this show, and so people can easily find that and ask any follow-up questions they'd like to today's
Perfect.
Show about your work, about your wife's work in pediatrics. Let's go to Samantha. Samantha, where are you calling from?
Well, I'm from Ames. I'm in Madrid at the moment, but
okay, you're in Madrid. Okay, from Ames. Tell us. We've got a short amount of time, but what's on your mind?
Well, my daughter has always had a little bit of an issue with sleep. She's almost 4, and she still needs a nap every day. But the worst thing is that when she wakes up, especially if she hasn't slept long enough, if she doesn't wake herself up, she screams, and she'll just cry until she either goes back to sleep or, I cuddle with her. Hmm. I don't understand it.
Well, you know, we have videotaped, and in fact, in the Encyclopedia of Sleep Medicine, we've shown what a night terror can be, screaming and crying from sleep. Again, according to Anna Freud, normal kids go through this. And there are certain things and stresses and pressures that might help precipitate these things. And I could give you references to that later. But kids can do that. And when they are inconsolable and you just hold them and you keep them in bed and they go back to sleep, Normal four-year-olds can do that. They might be at a higher risk as they get older, maybe to sleepwalk or have confusional arousals. But again, I'd give your daughter a hug until this grows out of it. But I would protect the bedroom environment. I would make sure there aren't sharp things laying around, because sometimes night terror kids can sleepwalk and fall down the stairs. But it's a normal phenomena until proven otherwise. But talk to your pediatrician, because if she shakes all over, bites her tongue, wets the bed at the same time, that could look like a seizure. There's a lot of things I would want to give you a differential before I just give you consolation, because that's what I hope you get, that you have a normal daughter too. Hopefully she'll grow out of this, but talk to your pediatrician before you start celebrating. Otherwise, just give your daughter a hug for me too. I think she's a normal kid who's going to outgrow this.
Samantha, thank you for your call.
Thanks.
And that's our last caller on this edition of River to River. Dr. Eric Dykin, such a pleasure to have you with us on this edition. I'd like to see you. Maybe we'll check back in with you in January in the depths of winter. We always talk about light as the days get shorter. We've got to make sure to dash out and get some of that sunlight, don't we?
Absolutely.
Okay. Dr. Dykin, thank you for coming into our studio. We'll look forward to having you back in a couple months' time.
Thanks.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. Also, help in Cedar Falls from Tony Daner and Phil Moss. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.